Jeff Miller takes your calls after the game, ESPN Chicago.
Swing and a miss, strike three. So Schultz has his first Major League strikeout. Hopefully got the nerves out of the way. Check swing on a high one. He went. That's a strikeout. The 0-2 pitch. Swung on and missed. Strike three. Third strikeout for the lefty. Here's an 0-2. Called strike three.
Well, the most pitches he's ever thrown in a game, 93. Challenge.
And we've got a challenge by the Rays batter. And it is a strike. And here comes the manager. So that'll be a good way to end your big league debut with a strikeout.
Yep.
And he'll get a great ovation when he walks off. He's hoping for a no decision. It's fist bumps from his teammates.
Fun to watch Noah Schultz at Wright Field make his big league debut earlier this week on Tuesday. And of course, if you had 500 of your closest friends and family members in attendance for your big league debut, you'd probably get a standing ovation as well, especially when you battled back from a nervy first inning, which I will say was the case for Noah Schultz. He retired Yandy Diaz, the leadoff hitter in that game, and then the next couple of hitters definitely seemed jumpy for Noah Schultz as he was struggling to find the strike zone, walked a couple of batters. Then I'll give Ben Williamson credit. The veteran second baseman for the Rays laid down a bunt and forced Noah Schultz to field his position, which athletically he did well. The problem came for Noah Schultz when something that's not an issue for him throwing the baseball was, and honestly, the location wasn't bad. It was near Edgar Caro's foot, which would have put him in good position to make a tag on the runner going home for the Rays. The problem for Noah Schultz was that he was about 12 feet away from Caro, and I think he threw the ball 98 miles per hour, which is great when it's coming from the mound 60 feet away, but a little too much heat on that one for Caro to handle. Schultz was charged with an error in the first inning. He ended up allowing three runs in that inning, but it was encouraging to see that Schultz was able to kind of shrug that off, find his rhythm throughout the game. He only allowed one more run in his 4 1/3 innings pitched. He struck out four, and here's the thing. He walked four, which is not something that's been an issue for him in the minor leagues. I think we'll watch him tomorrow when he makes his second start in Sacramento. The one battle that he'll be facing is that in Sacramento, the minor league ballpark, it's a bandbox. And with the weather warm there this weekend, Schultz is going to have to do his best to keep the ball in the ballpark, especially against this Athletics lineup, which is, you know, full of power hitters. But I'm excited to see how Schultz handles this, because now that he's gotten that first inning under his belt, and again, the stuff plays, I think what every good pitching prospect deals with in their major league debut is someone like Schultz in the minor leagues throws 98 miles per hour pretty routinely, you know, and we saw him, I think, hit 99 on Tuesday night. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in his career, we easily see him crack triple digits. One of the growing pains that good young pitchers have to kind of go through is just, I think people know this, but the step up in competition from AAA to the majors when it comes to hitters, right? You get two strikes on a hitter in the minor leagues and you've got stuff as good as Noah Schultz does, and you've got so many options at your disposal to get them out. And the truth is that a lot of AAA hitters with two strikes on them, you're just not going to get the same type of fights that you're going to get in the major league level. And I think that's what Schultz got a little bit of a taste of, because there were a few moments where he had two strikes on Tampa Bay hitters and didn't quite know how to put them away. He was throwing stuff that wasn't close. And I think that's the thing, is the cutter looked most effective for Schultz on Tuesday, but you're going to have to be closer to the strike zone. You don't necessarily want to be in it, if you've got, you know, an 0-2 or 1-2 count. But you have to be closer to the zone with major league hitters because they know to lay off stuff that's not close. And that's not always the case in the minor leagues. And I think that's something that Schultz got to see firsthand, and we'll see if he can make an immediate adjustment on Sunday or if it's still going to take some time. Even if it does, I'm not going to, you know, be in any way disillusioned by one. I wouldn't even call it a bad start. It was just his first start, and it didn't go perfectly, but I was actually more than anything really encouraged by what I saw from Noah Schultz, and it was fun to watch him. You're going to have a chance to listen to Noah Schultz, who joined Carmen and Yurko yesterday right here on ESPN Chicago, as he carved out some time to chat with the guys about what that first start was like for him. So when we come back, we will do that. Real quick, though, before we do take a break, let's pause 10 for station identification.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Sox fans, families eat free. Grab your family and head to the ballpark this season with a family pack. Starting at $21, each family member gets one hot dog, drink, chips, and a cookie. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, as promised, you'll hear from White Sox rookie Noah Schultz right here on ESPN 1000.
Hear Lennon DJ and High Def on 100.3 HD2.
Join us at the ballpark on Friday, April 24th, as the White Sox take on the Washington Nationals at 6:40. 10,000 fans will receive a Miguel Vargas bobblehead presented by Fanatics. Plus, it's the first City Connect Friday of the season. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Exciting week for the White Sox. Nice win last night to snap their three-game skid. And it was fun, even though the results didn't go the White Sox way. It was fun watching both Noah Schultz and Sam Antenacci getting a chance to make their major league debuts. As I mentioned, Noah Schultz joined Carmen and Yurko yesterday here on the flagship station, ESPN Chicago. Before I let you hear that real quick, I'll let you hear from White Sox Executive VP of Baseball Ops and General Manager Chris Getz on why the time was now for Noah Schultz.
Quite honestly, we just felt like, you know, he was at such a good place developmentally. You know, he had pitched to AAA, you know, last year. And, you know, with many of these arms or players, if they feel like they're ready to compete and help us win ball games up here, you know, we're gonna try to find spots for them to come up here, and we felt like it lined up pretty well with not only having an opening in the rotation with Shane going down and Noah throwing really well, and just wanted to capture, you know, his productive start and hopefully you can carry that over to the major league level.
Chris, what was like maybe the final trigger point to bring him up? Like, is dealing with the strike to walkout ratio, that's the thing that, or is it the eye test? What's like the final hurdle?
We look at the quality of the pitches. Is the stuff good enough to get major league hitters out? And then, you know, are the weapons also, you know, not just left-handed hitters? Does he have weapons to get righties out as well? You look at how well he's getting ahead of hitters, you know, staying ahead and putting guys away and kill counts, and he showed the capability of doing that. So there was enough there for us to be comfortable. Obviously, you take feedback from, you know, the AAA staff, player development, our pitching group, you know, our major league staff, you know, based on getting to know him, you know, through spring training and in the last couple of seasons. So, you know, it was unanimous that this was the time to bring him up, and needless to say, we're excited to have him here.
As Sox fans are as well, and as I mentioned, Noah Schultz, the lefty, joined Carmen and Yurko yesterday. If you missed it, this is what it sounded like right here on ESPN Chicago.
Yeah, whirlwind's definitely, you know, a great word to describe it. A lot of things that...
Let me interrupt, because I gave you a bad setup there. So Carmen asked Noah Schultz, hey, you know, having had a, you know, 48 hours or so to kind of reflect on what happened, what was it like? It seemed like it must have been a whirlwind day. And that's how Noah Schultz responded.
Yeah, whirlwind's definitely, you know, a great word to describe it. A lot of things that happened in such a short span. In the last week, it's been such a crazy time ever since, I was told that I was coming here. A lot of stuff happened in the game. I think that there were a little bit of nerves in the first inning, stuff that, I think I was pretty happy that I was kind of able to shake off, going into the second, third, fourth, and fifth inning. But then, like you said, something that really stood out and that I'll really remember was, being able to come off to standing ovation was really awesome. Having so many friends and family there was something that, I'll never forget. And that was such a great feeling.
Did you make it up here about as quickly as you thought? Or like, what were the expectations when spring training broke and you were going down to AAA? Did you have an idea of how long it would take or what they told you, how you could push them? What was that like being just down there for three appearances before getting called up?
Yeah, so I was really just told that, I was going to Charlotte, just kind of keep doing my thing. Had a pretty good spring. Worked on a lot of stuff in the offseason to kind of, correct things that, weren't necessarily going as right last year. I really had no sense of, a timetable of, when it would happen. It was just going out every day and, kind of going along with the grind of, the minor league season. It surprised me as much as it surprised, anybody else. It was just going out every day and, working hard, doing my thing. It surprised me.
What did you want to work on? What specifically was it that you felt you kind of had to hone going into this season?
Yeah, so last year I worked with my pitching coach, Mark Sheehan. I've been working with him since, I was probably 13 or 14. He's a guy that, has just been great, for my development and, helping me with, becoming who I am as a pitcher. Last year I think I was getting a little long with my mechanics and became a little hard to repeat, which we know had the high walk rate and, getting hit a lot, pitches weren't, doing what I wanted them to do. So I had a good offseason with him, working with him, shortening things up, keeping things compact, being able to throw more strikes that, in AAA that, was a lot higher of a strike percentage than I had thrown, last year. But something not that was new to me, something that, I had in there. But it was just great to, get back on track.
What's it like playing on a team like the White Sox where expectations aren't necessarily through the roof?
I've only been here, a few days still, but, it's something that, all the guys, every day, we're doing everything we can. We're doing all we can to, go out there and, try and get wins. It's something that, expectations are a thing that, you can hear from people, but I think that, every day, it's not like, we're not going out and trying, it's something that, we're trying to do, our best. And, put the best product out on the field.
Is it a dream come true getting drafted by an organization in your hometown or, close enough, your Chicagoland area? Or does it add like an extra layer of, pressure, if that's such a thing for you? I mean, what is that like when you were drafted by the White Sox?
I would definitely say dream come true. It was something that, having so many people in my family and friends that are all Sox fans that, when I got drafted, it was awesome. But, getting called up and, making my debut was something that, topped that by a lot.
The next day, Antonacci gets called up. At some point, Braden Montgomery is going to be up here. You've got a relationship with these guys as you've come through this system. Why should Sox fans be excited? Hagen Smith's another one. I mean, why should White Sox fans be excited about some of these young guys that are going to continue to get called up as we go through 2026 here?
Yeah, those are great guys. They're super talented and something that, guys that are going to help contribute to the team, definitely. I think that I always say that there's something that, we all kind of had in common is that, the last 2 years that, all of us in AA winning back-to-back championships that, it's just the winning culture. That's something that, you want to bring and translate higher levels and higher in, AAA and then obviously the big leagues. But I think that, us being able to play together and win, in the minor leagues is something that we know the feeling and, we're going to try and obviously bring that up.
Noah Schultz for a few more minutes joining us. It's Carmen and Yurik on ESPN Chicago and the ESPN Chicago app. Look, you've been in professional baseball for a little while now, and I know you just made your big league debut, but you've been in professional baseball. That said, being young, going through this the first time at this level, do you anticipate facing anybody that I wouldn't go so far as to maybe say that you're in awe of, but you're like, holy cow, I can't believe I'm actually going to be facing said batter. Is there anybody like that that you've thought about?
I try not to. I think that there's, definitely names that, there's guys that, obviously grew up watching. But, right. Now that, I'm in the major leagues, that it's something that, try not to look at that because, there's guys that I'm competing against. But there's definitely, I think there's guys that, are guys that, I've seen more times than not on TV and stuff. But, at the end of the day, you want to go out and It's a whole lot cooler getting those guys out than, you know, watching them on TV.
For sure.
That's kind of the mindset that I'm going with.
Absolutely. What do you hope for your second start? And what do you expect to be different about the second start this weekend?
Yeah, so I after the first inning, I definitely had a lot of nerves, but, you know, I had a lot of guys come up to me and, you know, kind of a lot of strategies, you know, telling me to breathe and stuff after the first inning. That, you know, that if I kind of made that adjustment, you know, in between the first and second inning, that, you know, the week that I've had building up to the second one, that, I mean, hopefully that's cleaned up a lot more. Something that, you know, I've had a lot more time to prepare. And I don't think that, you know, at the stadium, I haven't played in team, I haven't played against, obviously, but it's something that, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, I can be a little more comfortable out there because comfortability is something that, you know, helps you translate your product out on the field.
Sure. It's weird you guys have to play, you're in a minor league stadium this weekend and against the A's. It's still weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I never played here when I was in AAA, so I haven't seen the stadium, so I don't really know what's going into it. But, you know, I've heard good things about it. I've heard a lot. But, you know, I'm excited to, you know, go out there this week and play.
And Noah Schultz will get his second crack at Major League Baseball tomorrow afternoon. Today, Eric Fetty is on the mound for the White Sox up against Luis Severino, and then tomorrow, Noah Schultz will take the mound in the series finale in Sacramento, and he will be opposed by Jeffrey Springs, who is off to a really good start for the A's. So a couple of lefties on the mound tomorrow, and that should be a good one. I did want to note Eric Fetty versus Luis Severino today. Fetty obviously has been pretty solid in the early going here, even though he's got an 0-3 record. He carries a 3.38 ERA and a 1.06 whip. And so those numbers, you would sign up for those each and every day. And I'll point out that in Fetty's three, I guess, did I say starts? He's made two starts. He had an opener in the second appearance of the season against the Orioles. But in his three games that Eric Fetty has been either the starter or the bulk man, he has only received run support from the White Sox to the tune of 2 runs, 1 run, and shut out. So I guess the good news is that even though the run support has been descending for Eric Fetty in the early going from 2 to 1 to 0, it's impossible for him to get less run support today. So there's the upside for Eric Fetty today as he's on the mound against the Athletics and Luis Severino. So Severino is 32, and at this point, if you've been a fan of baseball for an extended period of time, you remember him coming up as a huge prospect for the Yankees, having a lot of success in 2017, 2018. He actually won 19 games in 2018, making 32 starts, and was thought to be, you know, potentially the next great Yankee starter at that point. He struck out 220 hitters in 191 innings that season. And then he had to undergo Tommy John surgery, only made 3 starts the next season. And obviously that kind of derailed his career and never really has gotten back to those heights. However, he's had moments and he's added a little bit of velocity this season, at least in the early going. He definitely did in the World Baseball Classic as well. But for Severino, the issue for him last year was the extreme splits. And when I say that, I guess home road splits. And part of that is due to the minor league ballpark that is Sacramento. And so what do we mean when I say, what's the difference between a minor league ballpark and a major league ballpark? Well, it's the second deck, you know, and the big issue and part, you know, for instance, it was a sellout last night and you had 12,000 fans creating a sellout for Sacramento. There's no second deck in minor league parks. And what that does, usually, you know, especially in a warmer, where there's generally a warmer climate in Sacramento most nights, you get a hitter's paradise, right? Balls get launched. The wind does, you know, the wind is not necessarily as big a factor in knocking them down and keeping them in a ballpark as it is in a lot of major league stadiums, and or they can be actually, you know, aided by the wind in a lot of circumstances as well. So Severino last season for the Athletics on the road, he was 6-2 in his 14 starts and 80 innings. He had a 3.02 ERA and an opponent's batting average of 222. That's if you double those stats, that's damn near, you know, a top 10 Cy Young finisher. At home last year, in 15 starts, Severino went 2-9 with a 6.01 ERA. I mean, that is ungodly awful. And if he hadn't been having the success that he had on the road, in most instances, Severino would have been removed from a rotation with numbers that bad. Now, he is one of the A's highest paid players. He was their big free agent acquisition the previous offseason. But so the White Sox get a crack at him in the spot where he has been dreadful. And it just makes you wonder, you know, hey, should the A's do something to try and manipulate Severino so that he could start almost and make as many starts as possible on the road? I mean, I know it's not really conducive, but when you have extreme splits that nuts, I personally would be like, hey, we need to do everything we can to ensure that he is making as many starts on the road and not in this park as possible, because clearly it does not agree with him. And maybe that is something the A's are trying to do this season, because three of his four starts have come on the road this year. His last start that he made was at home against the Rangers. The A's lost 8-1. Now, Severino was a little bit better than he has been normally in that spot. He went six innings and gave up four earned runs. But as you can see, certainly still struggling at Sutter Health Park. So hopefully the White Sox can continue that trend on Luis Severino later today. Hey, Sox fans, head down to the ballpark on Saturday, April 25th, as the White Sox take on the Washington Nationals at 3:10 p.m. 15,000 fans, 21 years and older, will receive a 90s City Connect jacket presented by Miller Lite. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Sweet, sweet jackets. So definitely all the more reason to join us at the ballpark on Saturday, next Saturday, April 25th. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. I will let you hear from Sam Antonacci coming up later in the show, but I do want to talk about the ABS challenge system and something that happened on Thursday, which was a historic day, and a White Sox player was responsible for that. We'll do that next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Hey, Sox fans, create your own game plan with a 10-ticket flex pack. You pick the matchups and the seats. Total freedom, total fun. For more information, visit whitesox.com/ticket plans or call or text 312-674-1000. Back here on White Sox Weekly as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the Sox and the Athletics later today. First pitch coming your way at 3:05. Our pregame coverage will officially begin at 2:30. But as I always like to say, we are in extended pregame coverage right now with White Sox Weekly. And as always, if you want to participate, the number is 312-332-3776 to talk some Sox with me. So, interesting conversation took place last night between Len Casper and Darren Jackson during the ball game when we had an almost non-challenge occur by Edgar Carroll. And I will let Len and DJ take you through the action and then follow up on their conversation after they're done.
The pitch. Low, and Carroll challenged it. And the home plate umpire didn't see it. Jeff McNeil says, hey, man, he challenged this. But Chad Fairchild didn't see it.
McNeil wants the challenge gone.
The A's are upset.
They're saying, no, he challenged it.
And he's going to ask the crew chief, Bill Miller, about it. Edgar absolutely tapped his helmet, and McNeil pointed at him.
McNeil, he's just saying, yeah, I want them to have one burned right now, because normally, you as a batter wouldn't encourage that.
And they are going to say it's a challenge. And I think Chad Fairchild is I think he just told McNeil, that's my bad, I didn't see it.
Yeah, and they already have shown that it was not a strike.
So the Sox lose one of their challenges. Yeah, you could tell Edgar regretted it and was like, what?
Yeah, he reached up and says, no, I didn't. You didn't see anything? Let's keep moving. And again, the circumstance, right? You're leading 3-0. We're in the fourth inning. They haven't had a base runner. The count is not that important right there. And for you to challenge that is just one where you're absolutely no need to do it.
I've got a thought on that.
What's your thought?
I agree with you, and I've read a little bit. Guys talking about the ABS system, and they've said it's a lot harder in the middle of the action than it appears from the outside. And I think when you're a catcher and you're trying to frame everything as a strike and you're doing everything to help your pitcher and you've got that stuff on your mind and it's a split-second decision, I think it's really hard for guys sometimes to not do it.
Well, I understand that part of it, but for me it's this. Before every pitch is thrown in this game, as a catcher, as a defender, you have to have already thought what's going to happen on the next pitch, including if you're going to challenge a pitch. You literally should be saying, okay, score is this, this, I'm not challenging in this situation. Just, you have to, unless it's blatant, you have to think about that before. You can't just react.
I agree, and I also think, and I've heard this from more than one person, don't challenge unless you're 100% sure. Well, Edgar might have been 100% sure that was a strike.
In his mind, absolutely.
So what is that, he supposed to do?
Well, that's the problem. You can't say that. I don't think you say, unless you're 100%.
If it's obvious, then challenge it.
Yes.
Well, guys are doing that, and they're getting it wrong.
Absolutely.
And Carroll had a great day with that yesterday.
He did, as Len mentioned, which I'm going to take you through here in a moment. But it's an interesting conversation as this continues to evolve, and we see the ABS challenge system in effect for the first season at the major league level. What is the proper strategy? I think we're all learning this together. I think the players are learning it together. I thought Len's points about, hey, it's real easy to say, hey, you got to be certain of this, but there's so much going on during an at-bat. And we saw or heard Edgar Carroll kind of go to the challenge yesterday and then kind of think back, oh, wait, no, I don't want to do that. But it's too late. Because if you're going to challenge, it has to be almost instantaneous for the umpire to recognize it. We heard there that Fairchild actually missed Carroll signaling on his helmet. It's so tough. And I think the big thing would be in terms of early innings, right? First, second, third. Should teams basically have a boilerplate rule? Hey, no challenges. First three innings, we don't want you challenging unless you've got a runner on base or a couple of runners on base. And I think count is critical too, right? Should catchers ever be challenging the first pitch? Certainly you want to be ahead in the count for your pitcher. But if it's the first pitch, it's the count's 0-0. And if it was close, you get two challenges. You get to be wrong twice. Right. So for every correct challenge that you have, you can keep going. You get one in its place. But they're so critical late in the game and in the leverage situations. And allow me. So Edgar Carroll in that moment has a bad challenge. But the previous day, Edgar Carroll actually had the most valuable ABS day by a player in its brief history in the major leagues. From Mike Petriello, who writes for MLB.com, from his article yesterday, quote, in the new world of ABS, one thing has been clear from the very start. Every challenge isn't created equal. It can't be. Leverage and situation are everything. Challenging the first pitch of the game, as Zach Neto did last week in Cincinnati, can't possibly be as important as turning a walk into a strikeout or vice versa, as we've seen on more than 250 occasions already. Or, even more valuable, taking or removing a run from the scoreboard. That being the case, while it's been enjoyable to watch balls and strikes flipped and overturned here and there, what we've really been waiting for is the one where it really feels like the outcome of the game hangs in the balance. And while we've seen game-ending overturns already. The Orioles were up 8-3 in the ninth when they did that. The challenge could only be so weighty no matter which way it went. We've gotten close. We've seen a pair of full count bases loaded walks get turned into strike threes when Cal Raleigh did it against Yanner Diaz on April 11th, and then when Carson Kelly did it against O'Neill Cruz on April 12th. We've seen it once from the batter's side too when Logan Ohapi turned a bases loaded third strike into an RBI walk on April 8th. Those were close, but they didn't quite scratch the itch because they came early on in the game, all somehow coming in the second inning. Now, what we've really wanted to see happen happened on Thursday afternoon in Chicago.
The pitch. Check swing. And it's low, and he will challenge it.
You just called it. Let's hope it's right.
The catcher is challenging.
Why not? If it's a ball, it's a run. It's a strike. He's out.
Huge challenge there by Edgar Caro. Flipped a bases-loaded walk into a bases-loaded strikeout. Now, ultimately, it didn't matter for the result of the game because the Rays went on to beat the White Sox pretty handily in that one. But Caro's challenge of that situation ended up being worth 1.8 challenge runs for Edgar Caro. So there's a lot of math that goes into this, but that challenge, flipping a bases-loaded walk into an out, was huge. And because Edgar Caro had also correctly challenged two calls earlier in the third inning, which were pretty critical as well, Caro ended up coming up with a plus 2.4 runs worth of value on his challenges. That's the most of any game in 2026. So it's an evolving situation. It's fascinating to watch. And I do think as the season unfolds, we're going to see more and more strategies put into play where I think players will have a better understanding of when teams want to allow them to go ahead and actually challenge pitches. Like, hey, early in the game, unless it's going to, you know, really be the difference of a run, or, you know, it's like a two strike count and you got rung out and you're pretty certain that it has a decent chance of being a ball. Most situations, I think teams are going to be better served saving them to more critical situations. So like last night, no bueno for Edgar Caro on that challenge. However, the previous day at Raid Field on Thursday, very bueno by Edgar Caro as he had the best challenge day in ABS history, in his brief history here at the major league level. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. It has been an exciting week of debuts for the White Sox. We've been talking a lot about what's good in the White Sox farm system, which led to my conversation with Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline. Where exactly are the White Sox in terms of their development path for a lot of players? It was a fun conversation. If you missed it, I'm going to let you hear it next right here on ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games on the go. The ESPN Chicago app.
Sox fans, bring your pup out to the ballpark on Monday, April 27th for Dog Day, sponsored by Tito's Homemade Vodka. Grab a seat in the outfield and watch the Sox take on the Angels at 6:40. Limited availability to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/promos. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly, taking you up to our pregame coverage, which begins at 2:30. And then, of course, we will have first pitch between the White Sox and Athletics coming your way at 3:05 today. A lot of excitement about the young prospects making their debuts this week. Noah Schultz, Sam Antonacci, and plenty more on the way. That is how I started my conversation with Jim Callis when I asked, okay, so I think Sox fans are pretty excited about what could be in the not-too-distant future.
No, I mean, they should be. And, you know, aside just from Noah Schultz, you know why I think this is kind of exciting? The White Sox, look, they're not going to contend this year, but they're getting closer to respectability. And I don't think this is, like, if you were just playing 100% for the future, you'd let him stay in AAA for more than three starts this year and keep the role going. And, yeah, you could get into the whole, hey, do we mess with service time? But, no, I actually think, you know, we saw the White Sox promote a lot of guys last year. There's going to be guys, Noah Schultz, just the first this year. And I think it speaks well for where this franchise is headed. I think they're going to be respectable this year. You know, we're not, I actually don't think they're going to lose 100 games. I think they're going to win more than 70 games, maybe that 75 range. And I think the willingness to call up Noah Schultz this early in the season kind of speaks to that. I mean, I know they're off to a 5-10 start, but I really do believe better days are ahead.
So, Jim, Schultz, you know, the one thing we've talked about it a lot here on the White Sox Network, Brian Bannister, Will Venable, you know, lots of people, Chris Getz throughout the organization have talked about Noah Schultz and how he dealt with a knee issue last year, which really kind of hindered him and put him in a position where he was, you know, compensating for that. And he got right over the winter, and then they saw it in spring training on display. And then what he did in his first three appearances, he, you know, he piggybacked Hagen Smith in that first game. And then the next two times out in starts, he was absolutely dominant. I'm completely with you too, because I like that the team is being aggressive with him, because honestly, if you look at the numbers, there was, he had only allowed 6 base runners in his 15 innings of work. You know, clearly he'd kind of mastered AAA, at least it seems that way. So no reason to delay. Let him come up on Tuesday and kind of, you know what? Hey, kid, see what you got. See what you can do against the best. So I am encouraged. And I guess I'll ask you, Jim, you know, because it's inevitable at 6'10", a lefty who, you know, might be able to crack triple digits on the radar here. It's inevitable. The name Randy Johnson is always going to be the one of the first names that people comp to Noah Schultz. But what I would point out is, like, we're living in like a completely different era of baseball. So maybe, just maybe, Noah Schultz doesn't need the ramp up period that Randy Johnson needed early in his career. Hopefully Schultz can just come out and be somebody who can be effective in his, you know, early going here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, 6'10 lefty, I mean, low slot 2, wicket slider. He doesn't throw as consistently hard as Randy Johnson does, but he can get it up there. And, you know, the thing people forget, and I'm not saying he's going to be better than Randy Johnson. I'm not going there. But Randy Johnson, like you were just alluding to, didn't really have a whole lot of consistent big league success until he was 26 years old. Noah's 22. And while Noah was tearing up the minors, Randy Johnson was getting lit up, you know, relatively. You know, he had an ERA over 5 in his career at Southern California. Like he never had the consistency. And I think the thing that has always stood out about Noah from a very young age is his body control and, you know, pitchability. Like, you just don't see, you know, when he was a teenager, when he first came into pro ball, you don't see 6'10" teenagers, you know, especially lefties, it seems like they take a little longer to develop, come in and just pound the strike zone like Noah Schultz did for day one, especially, you know, he's got, you know, we could argue his slider might be the best slider in the minor leagues. I mean, it just has so much movement. And yet, yeah, he gets chases with it, but he also can throw it enough for strike. You know, it wasn't just, oh, I'm throwing this pitch and I don't feel for it, or I have a fastball, but I don't know where it's going. Like, it's almost like, for all the, as good as his stuff is and as imposing as his frame is, I think the pitchability stood out. And, even if, let's say, his first taste of the big leagues doesn't go well for whatever reason and he needs more time in the minors, I think the encouraging thing right now is, you know, we have a guy who, you know, came into pro ball and they kind of handled him carefully. He had a flexor strain and a shoulder strain in his pro debut, so he didn't pitch a whole lot. And he came out, and I think he was 19 years old, and he was Double-A Southern League Pitcher of the Year in 2024. And you could argue he was best pitching prospect in baseball at that point. He was in that discussion. And then he didn't have a good year last year. And we all know he had the right knee tendonitis. I mean, he pitched well enough in Double-A, although he walked a lot more guys than he ever had, and he got knocked around at the end of the year in Triple-A. And I think everybody felt White Sox, you know, thus on the media side, okay, it was probably the knee. Mm-hmm. But you want to come out and see the Noah Schultz of old, and we've seen the Noah Schultz of old. I was just looking at a little baseball savant, because you can look up that stuff for AAA.
Yep.
And when he was getting knocked around in AAA last year, you know, his slider comes from a low slot. It has so much arm side movement. Glove side movement is what I meant. And last year, AAA, he was only getting, like, I looked at this, it's only 11 inches of movement in AAA, and the pitch got pounded.
Yeah.
Well, this year, it's back, and he's averaging 16 inches of glove side movement. And he's, you know, like, what's crazy about him is the slider and curveball break so much to the glove side, and then he throws more sinkers than four seamers, but his sinker and his changeup, which are his, you know, probably his least used pitch is his changeup, break in the opposite direction with a ton of movement too. I mean, the difference between where his slider breaks and where his sinker breaks, we're talking like 32 inches. It's almost 3 feet of difference on average where those pitches go. So if you don't pick up right away what's coming out of his hand, you have no chance against that guy. And I don't know how left-handers ever hit the guy, because it looks like he's 6'10 with a low slot. It's like he's delivering the ball from first base. I don't know how anybody stands in against him if you're left-handed.
No, it's a great point. Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline joining me here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network as we're currently in a delay between the Sox and Royals. No, it's a great point, Jim. Honestly, I don't know how many lefties are going to be in many lineups, when Schultz is actually on the mound. Maybe the Rays will, even the Rays, they're so platoon heavy. He's probably going to see a lot of righties on Tuesday. But it's fascinating to me here. You've got Schultz and one of the one thing the White Sox can certainly lean on, Jim, and you know this, is their ability to develop hard throwing lefties. We can go at Chris Sale, Garrett Crochet, that's Carlos Rodon. It's something that they have kind of specialized in. And if you had to pick something, it's like amazing, but they seem to do that really well. So that's a very encouraging thing to know that the White Sox have that type of infrastructure in place. Which is all the more reason why someone like Hagen Smith is really intriguing too. Now, we don't know how far away he is quite yet, but he's somebody who White Sox fans are very excited about. What have you seen from Hagen Smith, at least early in the season? Because I know last year wasn't probably the ideal situation. It wasn't exactly how Hagen Smith wanted it to go, but I know the White Sox were encouraged by what they were able to get back to. They were, what they worked on in the winter and getting him back to where he was in his college days playing at Arkansas.
Yeah, it looks like he's building that momentum. And you're right. I mean, last year, it was too early to maybe use the word frightening. But, he got off to a bad start. He wasn't commanding stuff. It seemed like his stuff all ticked down about 2 miles an hour. And, they had to put him on the developmental list. I mean, you don't expect that out of the guy you took fifth overall in the draft, pitched in the SEC, that you wind up putting him on the developmental list to work on his mechanics in the middle of his first full pro season. But he was very good at the end of the year in Birmingham when they won the Southern League Championship. He looked, I saw him a couple times in the Fall League, in the Arizona Fall League, and he looked like, what I'll call Arkansas Hagen Smith. I mean, he was by far the best pitcher in the Arizona Fall League. And again, it's small sample size, but you're encouraged because he's pitched 9 innings, he's walked 3 guys, he's struck out 14. If he has even his stuff, his slider and his fastball are so lively that I don't even think he needs, yes, you want to see average control. You like to see better than average control, but I actually think he's one of those guys whose stuff is so good that if it's even fringy control, he's going to be fine. And even last year in Birmingham, when he was walking guys, he didn't give up a lot of runs because he's impossible to hit. So it's not as extreme as a Jacob Mizorowski, where Mizorowski walked about 6 guys per 9 innings in the minors. But if Mizorowski's just around the plate, like nobody hits him. So he can give up. And I think Hagen Smith, while he's not as dramatic like that, like Mizorowski, I think it's the same type of thing. And so far this year, it's been pretty solid control. So it's interesting because, the White Sox obviously have been shuffling through a lot of guys in the rotation already in the season. But the fact that they call up Noah Smith is, Schultz is quick. It makes me wonder if we're going to see Hagen Smith sooner rather than later if he keeps pitching as well as he has.
I think it's certainly a possibility. And to your point about Jacob Mizorowski, Sox fans got a full vantage point of that on opening day when he absolutely just dominated the White Sox in that opener. So, just hearing that name, I think it probably gets White Sox fans pretty excited about the possibilities for someone like Hagen Smith. Jim, Tanner McDougal, he's somebody who I think White Sox fans have gotten to know recently, but last year he may not have been on the radar for a lot of White Sox fans, but he's somebody as a right-hander who throws really hard, and he has a pretty good relationship with both Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith as he's kind of, over the last 2 seasons, come up through the minors with them. So I'm curious what White Sox fans can be looking forward to when Tanner McDougal finally gets his crack at the majors.
And that could be soon too, because he's pitching well, and we know Charlotte's not the easiest place to pitch, and these guys have dominant stuff. And it's funny, like McDougal, he was part of the first draft combine. He had not had a good high school senior season this back in 21, and he pitched really well at the combine, interviewed really well. White Sox take him in the 5th round. He's an overslot guy. They're real excited about him, and he winds up blowing out in instructional league. That's that October. So he doesn't really get the full season ball to 23. He had a 6 ERA in 2024, and it looked like, okay, this is a guy with a big arm, but, you know, is he ever going to harness it? And, you know, he actually got knocked all the way down to single A during that 2024 season, and he got in better shape that offseason. And I think getting in better shape, if you talk to White Sox, they feel like it helped him get, you know, do a better job of locating his pitches. But, I mean, he's not as famous as Nola or Hagen, but it's pretty dominant stuff, too. I mean, he's upper 90s to 101. The one caveat is it's more downhill playing than life, so he's got to locate the fastball well. It can get dead zone a little bit if he's not careful. He's got a high-spin curveball to break so much that it can be hard to land, but it's also impossible to hit. He's got an upper 80 slider that also has tremendous depth. So he can wipe you out with three pitches. He's kind of similar. It's kind of a similar to a Grant Taylor mold where, you know, it's big velocity, it's overpowering breaking stuff, and, you know, still kind of trying to figure out how to harness it a little bit. But it's a huge arm. He's not a top 100 prospect like those other two guys are, mm-hmm. but he's also not that far off the list. Yeah. There are not many guys, especially in AAA, who can match Tanner McDougal's stuff.
Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline and MLB Network joining me for a couple minutes here on the White Sox Radio Network. Jim, so, okay, Sam Antonacci, he looks like he's close, and obviously in the World Baseball Classic with Team Italy, he kind of showed off that high baseball IQ and just the doing all the little things that I think a lot of White Sox fans are encouraged by and hoping to see in the not-too-distant future. So, Sam Antonacci, what have you seen from him, and do you think, since the White Sox have moved him primarily to left field here in Charlotte, do you think he can make the adjustment and handle the corner outfield spot?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to be a Gold Glover, but he, like Sam Antonacci's whole career is about getting the job done. You know, it's interesting. Is there talk that he might be coming up, or is that just rumor?
There's a report out there that has not been confirmed that he actually, you know, could be. But I'll caution White Sox fans. I think the organization wants to see him kind of get comfortable in left field before they just throw him out there. You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. And I would say, yeah, you kind of need to do that. I mean, again, you know, they're not trying to win this year, so it's not like they're calling him up because they got to win games right now. And it's very difficult to break into the big leagues learning a new position on the fly. Like, I hate when teams do that. But I would be a little skeptical that they would call him up. And I mean, I know the outfield needs some help, but I would be a little surprised by that. Now, that said, he's a very interesting guy. Like, he's an Illinois kid from Heartland, Illinois Community College, or at least Illinois College kid. Heartland, Illinois Community College, he was Division II Player of the Year, went to Coastal Carolina. And he's just, like, and I mean this in a positive way, he's an overachiever. Like, he's not going to wow you with tools. He's got very good bat-to-ball skills, and he finished fourth in the minors in on-base percentage last year. Like, he knows the strike zone. He makes contact. And, you know, other than that, I mean, if we're being honest, it's probably fringy speed. It's below-average power. It's average arm strength. But, like, he's one of those, like, you know, skilled gamer types who knows his game. So he doesn't swing for the fences. He focuses again on base. I said he's a fringy runner, but he's aggressive. He'll steal bases. He'll take extra bases. He's played all over the infield in college. I think he probably fits best at second base. And again, you know, he's made by fringy quickness and average arm strength, but it's really good instincts and a good internal clock, so he makes plays. So he's everybody's, I think, favorite, like, overachiever, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Yeah. And when he was in the fall league, like, I've said this before, kudos to the White Sox. Some teams don't send very good players to the fall league, but that was not the White. Well, we were supposed to get Noah Schultz, and he had the knee, so we didn't get him. But Hagen Smith was there, Ray Montgomery was there, and Sam Antonacci was there. And scouts, like, obviously, Ray Montgomery and Hagen Smith are first-round picks and famous guys. Scouts were just like, you know, pro scouts who had not seen or heard of Sam Antonacci were like, who is this guy? I love him. Just the fact that a lot of times, guys are worn out by the fall league. You know, you're playing baseball into November, and a lot of those guys have never done that. And you'll see guys, and they'll look tired. And everybody remarked that Sam came to the ballpark every day, high energy, ready to go. But all beside that, he just played. And I had one scout. It was an interesting point. I hadn't thought about this way. Everybody pretty much hits in the fall league. Like, the pitching isn't very good. It's a hitter's league. It's set up for hitters to excel. But one scout pointed out to me, he's like, Sam Antonacci hits the good pitchers in this league too. Hmm. Like, it's not, he's not just beating up on, you know, 26-year-old guys who are A-ball relievers. Sam Antonacci gets good swings against good players. I don't think he's necessarily the highest ceiling, you know, future all-star.
Yeah.
And when the White Sox are a true contender, he might be, because they have 8 million shortstops, they're going to have to distribute around the lineup.
Yes.
He may wind up being that really good utility guy.
Yeah.
But he can play. And that guy just keeps exceeding expectations. And, it'll be interesting. Like I said, I mean, I haven't really borne down on the left field aspect, but just given his attitude and tenacity, he'll get the job done. Like, yeah. It won't be Gavin Sheets or Andrew Vaughn in the outfield. Like, he'll make plays. He'll find a way to get the job done.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Jim Callis joining me for another moment here on ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. So, Jim, you mentioned it, a bazillion shortstops. That is, I think, the best problem to have these days if you're a good baseball team, because, of course, if you have a guy who can handle shortstop or, you know, capably at the worst case scenario, you can move him off of the most difficult position defensively on the diamond and find a spot for him. And the other aspect that White Sox fans are extremely excited about, not just Noah Schultz debuting on Tuesday, but it is the fact that they landed the top pick in the draft lottery this winter, which means I feel like each and every week, Jim, I'm doing a Rock Chalowski update on White Sox Weekly. Don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves because things can change, of course, during the draft process. But he definitely is living up to the billing of one of the top prospects out there. What have you seen from Rock Chalowski here early in the college baseball season? And, you know, do you think it's pretty close to getting to that spot where it's going to be tough for the White Sox not to select him in the amateur draft?
I do. He has lived up to the billing. You know, we said coming into the year, I've talked about him so much too. We do what we call Rock Watch every
yes.
week on our podcast. I kind of have my routine down. Like, coming into the year, I think he's, you know, the best all-around college shortstop probably since Troy Tulowitzki. He was probably the most preordained number one overall pick coming into a year probably since Adley Rutschman. Although, like you said, things can change because at one point Carlos Rodon was that guy, and he wound up going to the White Sox with the number three pick in the 2015 draft. But no, he's done everything I think people have hoped. The one knock on his game, if you're nitpicking, is he's probably a fringy to average runner, but he's worked and he's gotten a little quicker this year. But he's just a very polished player on both sides of the ball. We're still 3 months out. Grady Emerson, who's a high school shortstop from Texas, is also very talented. But I don't know if I should be – I was going to say, if I was laying odds, I don't know if I should be laying odds as an MLB.com employee. But I don't know. It feels like it's – like at this point, it feels like, I don't know, 75%, and maybe that's even a little bit light, that it's Rock. And, you know, you look at all the shortstops – in the system, you know, Billy Carlson, you know, who last year's first round pick was.
Real quick, Jim, because that's exactly the one thing I've grappled with this, right? Doing pre and post for the Sox here. So ultimately, and you always get into trouble because you can't project what's going to happen, but Billy Carlson was so good, is so good with the glove, you know, as a high schooler. You know, a lot of Scott said he's the best glove shortstop they've ever seen.
Yeah.
So how do you grapple with, okay, again, we say it's a great problem to have.
I've got it all figured out for you.
Give it to me.
I've got it all figured out for you.
Give it to me.
Billy Carlson's glove is that good, so he's your shortstop. Colson Montgomery, who had the best home run percentage for rookie shortstop who played in 70 games, he'll go over to third base. He's a big guy. That's fine. Rock Chalowski, number one pick, we're going to put him at second. He's very capable at shortstop, as is Colson, but Billy Carlson is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And Caleb Bonnemer, who's off to another good start after winning the Carolina League MVP award in his debut and looking better defensively than most scouts thought he would. Most scouts thought he was a definite third baseman. Now they're like, no, he's a legit shortstop too. I think he winds up on an outfield corner for you. So that's how we're going to distribute the four. Well, I'm already counting Rock as part of the organization. I don't know where we're putting Landon Tomei, if they can figure out a way to get Landon Tomei in the draft, too. Like, we'll find a place for him somewhere.
Locked in. Love it. Jim, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. You're the best in the business when it comes to breaking down the minor leagues and college baseball. So thanks for joining me here during Rain Delay Theater.
Oh, anytime. I'm glad I could fill in a little.
As is evidence. It's clear. We had a chance to chat with Jim Callis last Sunday before the Sam Antonacci call up was made official. So that was obviously why we were referring to him not being up just yet. But of course he is. And so White Sox fans are very excited about that. Speaking of Sam Antonacci, I'm going to let you hear from the White Sox left fielder, primarily at least. He started at second base in his debut. I'll let you hear from him and what he had to say the day he arrived at Rate Field. It was on Wednesday, the day after Noah Schultz made his debut. So I'll let you hear from Sam coming up here next. Sox fans, enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win the Ultimate Tailgate. The winner and seven guests will receive VIP access to the Minute Maid Spiked Tailgate and tickets to Friday, May 15th against the Cubs. You must be 21 years or older with a valid ID to enter. Visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. We'll take a quick break, but before we do that, let's pause 10 for station identification.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
All right, when we come back, I have a roster move from the White Sox earlier today, and I will let you hear from Sam Antonacci as promised right here on ESPN Chicago.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. We have a roster move from the Sox prior to today's game against the Athletics. The Sox claimed right-handed pitcher Osvaldo Beto off of waivers from the Atlanta Braves, and they also transferred right-hander Prelander Baroa to the 60-day injured list. Beto is 30, and he was designated for assignment by the Braves on Thursday. He has been roughed up so far this season, 7 earned runs in 10 innings. He does have one save, 6 strikeouts in 6 relief appearances, did make the Braves opening day roster after they claimed him off of waivers from the Yankees back on March 24th. Beto is 6'3", 210 pounds, and has an extensive career. He's gone 10-13 with a 5.13 ERA, 185 strikeouts, and 2 saves in 64 career games. Beto is a native of Puerto Plata in the Dominican Republic and was originally signed by the Pirates. Baroa, who is 26 today, actually, happy birthday, Prelander Baroa. He was placed on the 15-day injured list, and as he continues to recover from Tommy John surgery, as he's now been moved, as I said, to the 60-day injured list. When we come back, we'll let you hear from Sam Antonacci. This is White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The home of the Sox. This is ESPN Chicago.
Sox fans, pre-gaming made easy. Treat your group to a patio party, 2 hours of all you can eat, plus unlimited beer, wine, and Coca-Cola products. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Pre-game coverage officially begins at 2:30 with a first pitch coming your way at 3:05 as the White Sox look to win their second straight after hammering the A's yesterday. The White Sox will be starting for the fourth straight game. Sam Antonacci, who will be in left field for the third straight game. Antonacci began his major league career on Wednesday of this week, picking up his first hit in that game and starting at second base, where he has traditionally played most of his games in his career. But as Will Venable noted on Wednesday, Antonacci could expect to play mostly in left field. Antonacci met with the media on Wednesday before his debut and talked about getting comfortable in left field and where he feels most acclimated as a position player.
You played 3 positions so far this season at Charlotte, left field mostly. Is that where you feel most comfortable, and are you able to play all over the place?
Yeah, I'm comfortable wherever they put me. I take pride in that, and just being available in any which way I can.
How's the transition? You've been working a lot with left field. I know you hadn't done it a ton before this spring. How has that been, or how comfortable is it right now?
It's been fun. There's been a few changes that I didn't expect that have nothing to do with, like, the athletic ability. It's a very far run out there. It adds up over nine innings, and then you can get pretty boring out there, and then you get heckled a lot. I didn't realize that. You don't really get heckled in the infield. So, but no, it's been fun. I've had a lot of people in my corner helping me. Chad did a really good job. He's been in my shoes, so he did a really good job of just helping me understand what I need to do out there, and I don't need to do anything too crazy out there, and just be the player that I'm supposed to be, and just a lot of other outfielders just taking me in and helping me. So.
What was the best tackle you've heard out there so far?
Oh, I guess there's a lot of stuff online about me, so they looked that up. Yeah, they read up on it.
How did the WBC help you prepare for what you're about to partake of? I mean, it had to be a big boost.
Yeah, the WBC definitely, I think, will help prepare me for this opportunity. And that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to take that jump and play in it and leave spring training so I can be prepared for when my time came. And, you know, you're facing the best arms in the world in that tournament. And, I think I've seen the best of the best, and they're just going to help me continue to keep seeing pitches and play my game.
Who helped you there, you know, teammate-wise, and who's helped you the most here so far?
Yeah, there's a lot of leaders on the Team Italy side, especially KT. Even when he was hurt, he was still helping me and knew that, you know, I struggled a little bit down there and saw what needed to be worked on, and was able to use that and take it in throughout the last week of spring training, and then take it in the few weeks of Charlotte and really hone in on my craft. And then honestly, just everyone here has been very helpful in helping me become the player that I am. And I can't say there's no other organization that I'd want to be in.
Sam, this roster is a very young nucleus. If all goes well, you'll all grow together and, you know, hopefully be successful. What kind of feeling is that, you know, with being a young nucleus and hopefully all growing together, be a winning team?
Yeah, it's awesome to think about. Honestly, you know, I'm able to wear this White Sox jersey if it's for a day or if it's for the next 10 years. I'm going to go out there and give it all I got, and I think that's kind of the motto here. And the young guys that we got is we're leaving it all out there each and every night.
Sam and I talked to you after the spring breakout game. I know how competitive you are. We've seen how competitive you are. I think you might have been a little frustrated. You know, just it's only your second day in left field. Does it feel more like home now, having played there a few games and having done as much work as you have to learn the position? We know you can play the infield. Does the outfield feel a little more comfortable?
Yeah, definitely. Just continuing to get reps over and over in batting practice, and you know, that sometimes consists of not going in a group early and staying out there to get those extra reps, and just be as comfortable as I can. Charlotte, there was a lot of sun there and a building in the background that really made it a challenge, so I think it'll benefit me, and just continue to get out there and continue to get the reps in.
How would you describe your style to Sox fans getting to know you?
Just not taking the playoff on everything, no matter what the score dictates, and you know, if I'm ever seen as taking a playoff, I would like the fans to let me know or have someone else let me know, because I'll get that fixed, but I don't see that happening. And you know, I may not be, you know, a Shohei Ohtani or a unicorn like that, but I'm going to use all the gifts and talents that I have and just give it all I got.
What's the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome, whether that be in your personal life or baseball, in order to get here?
Definitely not being wanted, just as a baseball player growing up in college, and just the recruiting standpoint, and just continuing to you know, just bet on myself and believe in myself and keep on going. So.
Explain that a little bit. So what was it like coming out of high school? How many offers did you have, and what was your path?
Yeah, I didn't have a couple walk-on offers to Division I colleges, and then ended up going to junior college for 2 years, and then just put in the work and was fortunate enough to have a lot of options after that. And, could have gone in the draft after my sophomore year, but, bet on myself and didn't think I was really ready yet. And just to have that humility and be able to believe in myself for one more year and then go in the draft after that.
There you go, Sam Antonacci, earlier this week ahead of his debut. And he's already doing exactly what you would expect from him. Picked up a hit in that first at bat and made a really nice defensive play, a couple nice defensive plays at second base in his debut, and has looked solid in left field so far. And then last night, he drew a walk and did something that he did at a prolific level in the minor leagues, and that is reach base via the hit-by-pitch. That's right. Antonacci, I believe, memory serves, forgive me because I should have confirmed this again. I think if memory serves, though, he was hit by a pitch something like 59 times in his minor league career. And it's a skill, folks. I know, and we saw it last night. You kind of leaned into it, which is exactly what you love to see from a guy who just wants to get on base and give his team an opportunity to have some base runners to drive him in. And, you know, that's one of those underrated skills that isn't always talked about. But when you, at the end of the year, look at a guy who has a high on base percentage, sometimes that having that ability can certainly factor in and be a huge plus as a player who's willing to do what it takes to try and help his team win. And I think that's exactly what Sam Antonacci is going to be at the major league level. So excited to watch more of him today. Again, he's in left field for the White Sox. We'll have a starting lineup for you, of course, during our pregame coverage, which begins at 2:30 today, 3:05 first pitch, Eric Fetty up against Luis Severino as the White Sox look to take the series as they won the opener last night against the Athletics, scoring 9 runs. So that was a fun watch indeed. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, I do want to remember a baseball, let's call it Hall of Very Good, and an Angels legend. If you grew up in the 90s or the 2000s, you probably had fond memories of this player as we learned about the death of Garrett Anderson yesterday. So just want to reflect on him and his great career as an all-time great for the Anaheim Angels when we come back right here on ESPN 1000.
It's simple. The ESPN Chicago app.
Being sent out to the mound to talk to Levon Hernandez. A high fastball to Garrett Anderson. Rifle down the right field line.
Game 7 of the 2002 World Series. Garrett Anderson came up clutch, as he usually did throughout his career. The longtime Angels outfielder who spent 15 seasons with the Angels, we learned yesterday, had died at the age of 53. And first and foremost, you know, I think anybody who had a chance to get to know Garrett Anderson only had fond things to say about him. Outpouring of emotions and warm thoughts about Garrett Anderson. Obviously, 53 just feels way too young for anybody. And I'll just, Freddie Freeman posted, gave an interview, and he said, quote, "You always hear, don't meet your heroes. But then I got to meet him. And I was like, I'm glad I did, because he was a beautiful man. And I wish he was still here. He meant a lot to so many people. I'm at a loss for words." Freddie Freeman did grow up as an Angels fan. So a left-handed hitter, Freddie Freeman, who is likely Cooperstown bound himself. You know, Garrett Anderson didn't get the call, but he was probably somebody who was, you know, just on that very, very good, you know, and didn't, you know, if he had had a little bit more power, maybe he would have made it. But Freeman went on to say, as a left-handed hitter, seeing him being able to hit line drives to left field whenever he felt like he pleased, he could do it. He made me, as a little boy, love watching the game of baseball. I just loved watching Garrett hit and Darren Erstad play defense. When you're taught to hit the ball to left field and then you see a major leaguer who is pretty much doing what you're being taught to do, you gravitate towards him. So fond thoughts from Freddie Freeman about Garrett Anderson after having the chance to meet him in his playing career. And Garrett Anderson, you know, is one of those guys who I think was always just a little bit underrated. And then your team, the White Sox, would play the Angels, and it always felt like he was just somebody who would really make you wonder why he wasn't a bigger name in all of baseball. And part of it was, you know, I just read the Freddie Freeman quote referencing Darren Erstad. There was also, you know, when Garrett Anderson arrived in late 1994, he was a rookie in 1995 with the then California Angels. He arrived in an outfield somewhat unheralded because they already had Jim Edmonds and Tim Salmon in center field and right field. And Garrett Anderson, who was a center fielder, moved over to left to accommodate Jim Edmonds. And naturally, you can understand why, because Edmonds was, for the most part, a perennial top three finisher in the Gold Glove award voting. And so they moved Garrett Anderson to primarily left. Now, Anderson would move around from right field to center field, wherever the Angels needed him, and always play a more than competent defense. And he really came into his own starting in 1999 when he turned 27. And for a five-year stretch, Garrett Anderson from 99 through 2003 averaged per year 28 home runs, 112 RBIs, 7 stolen bases, and he had a 300 batting average. And he had a 509 slugging, an OPS of 836. Just the model of consistency in the middle of that Angels order. An Angels team that, as we just played right there in that clutch moment in the 2002 World Series, would go on to beat the Giants and win the World Series that year. And again, a lot of times it was just Garrett Anderson, great player, but always, you know, the third or fourth name. But in the 2002 season for the Anaheim Angels, Garrett Anderson had a 5.1 wins above replacement. Now that trailed Darren Erstad, who was 6.3, and actually David Eckstein, who scored in that highlight, who had a 5.2 wins above replacement. And Troy Glaus was consistently a teammate with Garrett Anderson. Glaus always had the big home run numbers. So it's just one of those things where Garrett Anderson was, for a lot of people who watch, and I think a lot of people would tell you this, the heartbeat of that Angels team that did win a World Series. Anderson played 15 years for the Angels. He won that 02 World Series. He was inducted into the Angels Hall of Fame in 2016. Some of his career achievements: he was a 2-time Silver Slugger Award winner, a 3-time All-Star, and 4 times he was recognized as the Angels team MVP. And in terms of the franchise records that Garrett Anderson holds, most games played for the Angels, most at-bats, most hits, 2,368, most total bases, most extra base hits, most doubles, and most RBIs of any player in Angels history. Garrett Anderson gone well too soon at the age of 53. Rest in peace, Garrett Anderson, just a great, sweet, left-handed swinging hitter in the middle of the Angels order for 15 seasons. So sad news there. Just wanted to remember and reflect on one of those hall of very good players. So that's going to do it for this edition of White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. Want to say thank you to Mario Heron and the executive producer of White Sox Baseball, which is Brendan Riley. Stay tuned, folks. Don't go anywhere, because White Sox baseball is on deck. 3:05 first pitch, but the pregame coverage starts at 2:30 right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.